Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, we are in a very good mood this week, which doesn't always happen when you do a show all about death all the time, because we won not one, not two, but three British Podcast Awards on Saturday. And as you can hear, my voice is still sore and I still feel a bit hungover. We won Best Entertainment, I know, a bit shocking, Best Interview and Podcast of the Year. I'm still a bit stunned, and I want to say a massive thank you to all of you for listening. If it wasn't for you having such excellent podcast choices, we would not have won. So thank you, genuinely thank you for wanting to hear about death and grief and for being brave enough to listen and allowing this conversation to just get louder, because it is only by talking about these very hard and difficult things that we can start to understand them and help ourselves and each other. Okay, I don't want to sound like I'm giving a speech at Harry and Meghan's wedding, but what a speech, though. My goodness, cried my eyes out. And not just because I was watching those, you know, two boys who are definitely in the club. So it's a good reminder, it happens to everyone. You are not alone. This week's guest is the brilliant Adam Megiddo. Adam is the co-founder of the Olivier Award-winning showstopper, The Improvised Musical. If you haven't seen them yet, go. They are absolutely incredible. He's also an award-winning director and writer. He's worked extensively with Ken Campbell when he was alive and also with the Mischief Theatre Gang, who created The Play That Goes Wrong. Adam came in to talk to me about both his parents, his father who died this year and his mum who died 18 years ago. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with one of the country's best improvisers, Adam Megiddo.
I was so intrigued as to how you were going to introduce me. And that is a crazy one. I was not expecting that. That came straight out of left field.
But I did it because I thought it'd make you laugh.
Yeah, it did. Oh my God.
The world's most bestest improviser, Adam Megiddo.
An improviser. Yeah.
Writer as well, to be fair. Mm-hmm,
yeah, I do some writing and directing. Yeah.
And directing. You do lots of directing. You creator of Showstopper, the improvised musical.
Co-creator.
Yeah. Sorry, Dylan. I actually know you both.
Co-creator, director.
So you came up with the entire thing and you invented improv. But do you get that a lot? I feel like because I'm only saying this because we both do impro / improv. Don't get us started on the difference. It's too long.
Yeah, there's a book there.
But we've been doing it for a long time. But then there's people who've been doing it longer. It's so complicated. It's political. But I think because you do Showstopper and I do Ostentatious, and at the moment they are visibly famous.
Yeah.
So then sometimes we do interviews. They're like, "So you invented improvising?" And you have to be like, "Oh no."
No. That was something like 60,000 to 70,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Other people did it.
Someone was like, "Let's pretend we've got dinner."
Yeah.
And then they had a nice time. I'm sorry, you did. You co-created Showstopper. Mm. But I think you're one of the best improvisers.
Well, that is very kind to say.
I never
consider myself anything like that, of course.
Really?
But in the UK? I'm just aware of seeing so many amazing improvisers that I sort of struggle to keep up with them. So for me, it's more like, creating stuff and being a creator of things and a teacher of things. And I'm just very lucky to be involved in half of them, to be honest.
You're so modest.
No, I mean it.
I think sometimes when people say best, it implies that everyone else is shit. I don't mean that. I mean, there's lots of amazing ones, but you're one of my faves.
Oh,
and you're definitely one of my fave teachers. I think you're because lots of people do improv and then just start teaching.
Yeah.
And like that, those two skills don't necessarily come together.
No.
But I think you are a good teacher and a good improviser.
Thank you. I do love teaching.
Yeah,
I'm passionate
really
about teaching. Yeah, I've been teaching for a long time. I started teaching so long ago because I was so disappointed with the tuition I was getting. So at the age of 18, I started teaching.
Really?
Yeah. Because I thought, hang on, this doesn't feel right. There's got to be a better way. So in a way, teaching was a method of creating the environment that I really wanted to learn in.
Wow. That's amazing.
So I've been doing it for a long time.
Adam, who are we remembering today?
You know what? Pretty much everyone. They've all gone. They've all gone. Pretty much all of my family have gone.
Wow.
My mother, my father, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles.
Wow.
So I have a sister and she has a son, and that's kind of my family left, really.
That's it?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So where was your... Do you want to start at the beginning or the recent? I feel like...
Wherever, really.
Yeah.
Here's the other thing that I've realised about this. As soon as I put down the phone to you and agreed to do this...
Yes.
I realised I have never spoken about this at
all.
Wow. I just haven't spoken about it. So I have no idea what's going to happen to me emotionally as we talk about it. I genuinely don't know. And maybe why I haven't spoken about it is part of
the discussion.
I don't know.
Because we've known each other a long time and I recently found out you were telling me you had someone you knew had died, someone in your family, recently. And I wasn't like, as other people, I'd be like, oh, do you want to come on the show? And I was, again, like, does Adam want... I wasn't sure.
Mm.
Whereas with other people, I'd be like, oh, sure, that I know that they'll talk about it. But I think it's... You're very open, but you're also very private about some things.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is unusual in performers, because sometimes performers, it's like, it's just all there. You know everything. You know what I mean? You know who they slept with. You know what they're eating. You know, just everything.
At the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just haven't spoken about it. And I don't really know why that is. I just... I don't know if it's a closed subject and it's something I haven't investigated, or if it's something that I've sort of processed very quietly and personally.
Yeah.
But other than the obvious conversations that you would have, you know, organising funerals and things like that, or close friends who would say to you, are you okay? Certainly haven't talked in any length about the fact that all my family are gone.
Yeah. Oh, I feel very privileged.
God knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, but I don't know where to begin. Let's work backwards.
Yeah. My father died recently. Yeah. So that was a few months ago.
Yeah, which is, I think, let's start there, because that's when I had the conversation with you and I was like, oh, okay. So what's your dad's name?
So he was called Ivor Megiddo.
Ivor Megiddo.
And he was a dancer and choreographer who came over from the Middle East in the 50s.
Wow.
So he was born in Cairo in the late 20s. And his family were travelers, you know, they're sort of, his father was from Greece, I think Corfu, and his mother was French, Italian, Russian.
Wow.
So there's a huge mix
in
that family. And they came over to settle in Cairo and then into Israel and then came over here. He came over here in the 50s to study at the Royal Ballet School.
Wow.
And then he went on and had a career as a dancer and a choreographer and then eventually a teacher.
You've talked to me about your dad before, and he does sound like the most exotic man possible. Like
He's a character. There's no doubt about it.
A I saw very a picture strong Omar character. Sharif, like in my head, like that kind of like.
If you picture a smaller Omar Sharif with a toupee, then you're not far off. Actually,
okay,
you're not
cool.
too far off.
Yeah. And what was your relationship like with him? I know that's a simple question.
It was extremely problematic.
Right. Yeah.
We didn't speak in the last 7 years of his life.
Wow, last 7 years?
Yeah.
Was there an incident that caused that? Or?
No, there was a build-up of incidents over a long period. He was a very, very difficult man. And it's difficult to really pin down exactly what that was all about.
Mm.
And one could probably puzzle over that for a long time. But for me, he was, I think, a solipsist in that the world only really existed in terms of how he perceived it.
Right.
So that's going to make for some very difficult family relationships.
That doesn't
and very,
make
very
dad
challenging.
Issues. No. Like doesn't make a good dadding, does it? Like
no, it's problematic. And it took me a long time to realise, oh, well, that's actually what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, this is not an evil man.
Yeah,
This is just a man who has his own issues. And I think I've kind of picked my way through a lot of them.
Yeah.
I managed to separate, therefore, my own issues from his.
Yeah, yeah.
But even though we had a sort of on-off relationship for many years, it got to the stage where I thought, this is sort of a difficult, almost abusive relationship in that he's quite, he could be very verbally and emotionally abusive. So I think if I was advising a friend of mine what to do, I'd say, get out of it and don't look back.
Yeah.
And I sort of listened to my own advice and I thought, well, I really feel that I've done many, many things to try and have a relationship.
Mm.
I've tried to rethink it from his point of view, from my point of view. I've tried broaching the subject with him. I've tried talking about it. I've tried not talking about it. I've tried so many things that in the end I thought, I think this is over and I think I should go for my own well-being and my own sanity, which is what I did.
So 7 years ago, you didn't have like a big row. You just sort of stopped.
We did actually have a huge row, but it was the end of a long build-up of a Cold War.
Wow.
We had a huge row. And I've been trying to think, is that the last time I spoke to him? I'm not sure. It might have been. We might have spoken a few times since then. I just can't quite remember. That's certainly the last conversation I remember having because it was a big argument. And that was about, so that was 7 years ago. Yeah.
And did you, in that argument, did you kind of say, like, that's it? Was it that kind of, or was it just an argument?
No, it was just a, you know, it's a lot of things that needed to be expressed, stuff that I'd been holding back. I just wasn't prepared to hold it back anymore.
Wow.
So it was expressed it loudly on the phone on the steps of the drill hall.
Oh, God.
It was a horribly public scene.
And this is a privilege of having someone you know come and do this show, like, because I've known you for a while and you have a very contained energy that's very nice to be around. But the idea of you shouting, I can imagine, it's quite scary.
Well, I don't lose my temper very often, but when I do it, it really blows.
And that's what I mean.
He was someone whose temper blew all the time. I mean, he was extremely temperamental and would fly off the handle, and then it was as if it never happened.
Wow.
And that's just it could also be to some degree part of his cultural upbringing, that people express themselves a lot more like that. But it didn't feel that way growing up, and you had to really kind of unpick all that as I grew older. I had to really unpick that. So I've always felt that losing one's temper in that way was a slightly ugly thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Very British of me. but I do feel that. And it's very difficult to shake that off, actually.
Yeah.
I have that with me for life. It's like, oh, I don't even want to lose my temper in public.
I can understand if your dad is, like you said, not from here and loses his temper all the time.
Yeah.
As a child, that is probably very scary and confusing. So I can imagine making a decision of like, okay, it'd be safer and easier if I don't do that.
Yeah, I think so. And I was a particularly oversensitive child.
Oh, bless.
You know, really kind of frail, fragile, sort of skinny thing. And
I'm baby Megiddo.
Yeah, and it's just like, it wasn't a good mix. It was not a good mix. But therein lie life's lessons.
Yeah. Are you more like your mum, would you say, then?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So your dad died a couple of months ago. What happened? How did you find out then if you're...
Well, my sister has really given up a huge part of her life to be his full-time carer and to look after him as he's basically just broke down through old age. And he was 92 when he died.
Wow.
So for the last 12 years, my sister has really been... a saint and has given up her life to look after him and to take all that crazy behaviour from him and absorb it.
Did they get on better?
They had a very tempestuous relationship. I mean, there was a time, you know, going back 20 years or so, where she wouldn't speak to him.
Right.
Pretty much everyone who ever knew my father fell out with him.
Right.
All of his family refused to talk to him at different times.
Yeah.
So my sister knows exactly what that's like. But she really came to the conclusion that she wanted to make sure she would see him out of this world and be with him for whatever that took. And it's come at huge personal expense to her,
doubt.
Yeah. But she's been amazing the way she's done it. So it was my sister who was looking after him. And I got the text on the Saturday morning of the London 50-hour improvathon.
So we should explain. We should just pause and go. So the improvathon is a thing that we both do.
Yeah.
That you started. You set it up.
Well,
really.
I brought it over from Canada. Ken Campbell had brought it over once, and we said, "Oh, let's do this." So then I started producing it. Yeah.
So we improvise for 50 hours, and people go, "Oh, but you don't do the whole thing." And
why'd you do that?
And we do. Yeah. So if we start on Friday night, we finish on Sunday.
Mm.
And I mean, not everyone, like some people just come and do 2 hours, 3 hours, or since I've had a baby, I do like four and I'm like, bye guys. But most people do non-stop improvising.
Mm.
We have like, there's a break every hour, 45 minutes, isn't
it? Yeah, you get a 15 minute break every hour, 45.
And the equivalent we always say is like, it's like watching a box set. So it's like you just settle in and you do 50 hours.
Yeah.
And with the audience, some of the audience stay for that whole long time. So you get the call, just to put this in context, on the Saturday morning.
Yeah, so I'd been awake for... Oh, I don't know. Well, I'd already been awake for about 30 hours.
Yeah, oh my God. Yeah. It makes me feel sick now. Now I've had a baby, I can't cope with it. I'm just like, no, Adam, no.
Yes, sleep deprivation is not part of entertainment for you, is it?
No, not anymore. Not anymore. It's a sign of a breakdown. The idea is like the less you sleep, the purer you can improvise because you're obviously not really thinking anymore. You're just
Your censorship reacting. System kind of is too tired and it just falls asleep. So you have this freedom that you don't normally get.
Yeah. Which can result in some very funny scenes.
For sure.
And also some very startling.
Yeah.
Startling.
No doubt.
So you get, you say you got a text.
Yes.
So you were, and we should also say, you normally don't perform, you're normally directing. So you're normally calling the scenes and sort of shaping the show.
Mm.
If you don't understand how we're explaining it, come and watch it. We do it once a year. That's probably the best thing to say. So I can't imagine your mental state anyway, because you haven't slept for 30 hours and you're controlling about 25 imaginary people at this point who also haven't slept, so are kind of looking to you really as a god/father figure at this point and kind of being like, Adam, my character's not doing anything, can you please like make me feel better?
Yeah.
As people do to you in the improvathon. Did you just go, nope, not going to deal with this, I've got a whole weekend, or did you...
I don't know. In many ways, it might have been the best way to find out.
Yeah,
because I was involved in something and I love that improvathon so much and I love that community so much that I just had to carry on. But also, you know, I hadn't had a relationship with him for 7 years, so in many ways I kind of had already disconnected.
Yeah.
So my sister kept saying to me on a number of occasions, you know, are you going to be all right with this? She'd say, are you okay with this? Because there's going to come a day when we hear that he's died, and are you going to regret that you didn't have a relationship with him? And I kept saying, look, every time you ask me, I think about it as freshly as I can.
Yeah.
But I feel I've made peace with this, and that's my decision, and that's what it's going to be. So actually, when I got the text, I was amazed at how how calm I was when I got it. And I just suddenly, in many ways, just felt a relief because I knew that, he'd been suffering. And even though I didn't have a relationship with him, I certainly didn't want him to be suffering.
No.
So I knew that his suffering was over and that to a large degree, my sister's suffering could be alleviated. And I felt a sort of a sense of inevitability and a sense of release looking at it and going, well, there you are. That's it now.
I think for some people, I can understand, like, especially, you know, I have a brother and I can understand, like, that sisterly worry of, like, oh, has he really thought? But I think because, again, this is only because I know you, you think about things so much and I think you don't take things lightly. But I can understand, you know what I mean? I think for some people it would be like, that's it, I'm not talking to them. But I know that you would have weighed that up.
Yeah, sure.
Very heavily and made that decision with great thought. Yeah. So I think I can totally understand how that when you get the text, you're like, yeah, I am okay with this.
And one can't say, you know, you can't say that is the right or the wrong decision. No, all you can say is, well, that felt right for me.
Yeah.
And I still feel that that was the right decision for me.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was.
I think that's the hard thing with grief and parents and that relationship of, like, there isn't a right or wrong. It's like you said, it's just, like, that's so interesting that your sister was able to go, no, the right for me is to be absolutely involved in this man's life. And the right for you was, like, to be completely not involved. Like, completely different reactions. But it sounds like you were both being very honest.
Mm.
It's very good that your sister was, and you were able to support each other. Because I can imagine if it was a difficult relationship, it might be like, well, you know, fuck you. Now I'm doing everything or you're not involved. And
No, my sister never put pressure on me in that regard, which is part of her amazing sacrifice. I think because she knew that that would just, I don't know how I would have coped with it. I wouldn't have been able to maintain that sort of relationship because I just wouldn't have been able to go back there and had that relationship with my father. So in my only regret really is that I wasn't able to support my sister more because of the decision I made. But I really do feel that I had to make that decision for my own survival, really.
Yeah.
Those were not easy times in my childhood.
Oh, God, but you have to know yourself really well to be able to do that. Like, I think a lot of people do things out of, oh, I'm going to do it because I feel bad or because I feel this, you know, I should. I think to have the strength, I think it takes a lot of strength to know yourself that well, to go, this is what I have to do, this is what I need, otherwise I'll collapse. Like, I think that's, I'm saying a nice thing about you.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I'm weighing it up as you're talking. I'm thinking, is that right? It does feel right. I mean, it feels like the strength of it is probably in that I haven't changed my mind since.
Yeah.
That I feel that was right for me. And that was, to be honest, it was a survival tactic.
Yeah.
It was like, I really have to do this if I'm going to have my life back and live again. You know, I have to do this.
God, it is. Because I also talk like, me and my dad had a difficult relationship, definitely. But I don't think it was ever as bad that I felt I couldn't have, I don't know, obviously, because he didn't live past me being 15. But in my head, if I imagine him still around, I think it would have still been tempestuous, but I still would have wanted him around. Like, I still would have been okay.
Yeah.
And I have friends who have very complicated relationships with parents who literally go, I can't be near them. And I think it is important. And some people, it isn't worth it.
It's a personal thing.
Yeah.
What can you say? It's completely personal.
So did you go to the funeral?
I did.
Did go to the funeral.
It was the second funniest funeral I've ever been to.
Of course, the first being?
The first being another great loss for us, which is Ken Campbell, who was a great teacher for us and a mentor, really, and a door opener for both of us, wasn't he?
Yeah, definitely.
Wasn't he?
Definitely.
That was an entertaining funeral. Yeah.
So, what happened at your dad's?
it was such a strange event. It was very small gathering.
Mm.
It was me and my sister and her immediate family, and Ruth was with me, and then some of my father's other family. He had another family before my family were there, but that we hadn't spoken to them for many, many years, really. So it was a very small gathering, and my sister asked me to select the music, and I thought, well, he was a dancer, and I thought, you can't have miserable music all the time. I thought all that jazz would actually work quite well. And I did sit down and I pictured this, and I went, I can imagine being there and they're playing all that jazz as we're just taking a moment to remember him. And I thought, yeah, that would work, actually.
Yeah.
All that jazz from Chicago.
Yeah,
I can see it. What I didn't anticipate is that they would use it as the play-out music for the coffin. So when the guys came in to lift up the coffin, they did it in time to the music. I don't think they'd planned to. I just think they heard da-da-da-dum-bum. bum, and they couldn't help it, and they started literally bending their knees on the beat, da 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 dum, and lifting the coffin. I was sitting there going, I can't believe this is happening. And then we were following the coffin out. I was with my sister, and we were behind the coffin, walking down the aisle of the chapel, and my sister said, Adam, who is that woman? And we looked over, like a bank of empty seats, and there was this woman sitting there at the back, grey-haired woman, who neither of us had ever seen before.
Oh, my God.
And she said, who is that? I went, oh, it's probably going to turn out to be our real mother. I mean, our family is so filled with bizarre, eccentric secrets that who knew who that woman was?
God.
I don't know who that woman was. None of us know who that woman was.
Just random.
But it was one of, yeah, it was one of those bizarre moments of
that
you get really only in death.
I'd like to point out, you have worked with the Mischief Theatre guys quite a lot, who do
Yes,
Play That
I
Goes
love
Wrong.
Them dearly, yeah.
And it feels like you might have accidentally directed a farcical funeral.
The funeral that goes wrong.
Yeah, that goes wrong. It feels like your comedy instincts were just too good. And you were like, actually, all that jazz would be quite funny. Oh, my God. So you still don't know who the woman was? It's just a random woman?
No, no idea who it was.
Oh, my God.
But we did, you know, it was an unusual upbringing. And what's so unusual about it is that I didn't get how unusual it was until a lot later in life. Because, of course, you normalise everything and you think,
know,
oh, that's normal, right? And then you see your neighbours and you think, oh, that's a bit weird. Why do they live like this? But actually, then you realise, no, actually, we've had a very strange life. Both my parents were dancers.
They were both dancers?
Yeah. My mother was my father's student. 20-year gap between them.
Scandal at the time, I imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So maybe she was just another random... Well...
Could have been another student. Who knows? Who knows?
So this was just a couple of months ago.
Yeah, a few months ago now.
So since then, you're feeling like... Like, do you feel like you're grieving, or do you feel like you did that a while ago? Because
I think I did that a while ago.
Yeah.
Now, of course, my main concern is for my sister. I think I made peace with that a while back.
That's amazing. I think that's really amazing.
Yeah. I mean,
a lot of people
don't know.
Yeah,
you never
know.
It might come and hit you when you're least expecting it. But it does feel peaceful, and it does feel like I've made my peace with that. And in order to like you said, you said, oh, you must have thought about that decision and must have had a certain strength in it. To validate that decision, you have to be absolutely sure that that's right.
I think that's it. If you're going to say, I don't want to speak to your father, like, you got to know that when time comes, you won't regret it. You're like, no, this is the right thing to do.
And I'm genuinely glad that he's, not suffering anymore.
Was he very ill?
It was a long, drawn-out...
What did he die of in the end?
I don't know. In the end, I think it really was just... he'd been really degenerating for a very long time. I mean, for a very long time.
Wow.
Over 20 years or so.
God, and as a dancer, that must be hard as well.
Yeah, that was very, very hard for
him. Not to be able to physically do what you want to do anymore.
Yes. Later in life, he took up art. That was his thing. That was fine. So he did a lot of painting and drawing of people and would sit in Brent Cross Shopping Centre drawing people. So if you were ever in Brent Cross...
I spent a lot of time in my childhood.
In the 90s or the noughties? Then you would, and you saw that man who looked like Omar Sharif with a toupee painting you. That was my father.
Do you know what? I'm pretty sure I did.
Yeah.
I basically lived at Brent Cross, thanks to my mother being like,
you would have done.
What do you want to do at the weekend? Should we go to Brent Cross? Trip to Brent Cross, everybody. I thought that's what people did until I realised she was shopping.
Yeah.
Probably
yeah.
Me and my brother thought it was a fun thing to do. So that's obviously your most recent one. So when did your mum pass away?
So my mother died 18 years ago.
18 years ago. Wow, so how old
are
you?
So I was 29.
Oh, that's quite young.
And she had, that was breast cancer.
And were you much closer to your mother?
Much closer to my mother. And that was a really, incredibly difficult time and very, very difficult experience. And still is. Actually, that one still is because, something happens and I think, oh, I must just call my mum and tell her. And then you catch yourself and go, yep, can't do that. And it still happens 18 years on.
I know, it's ridiculous, isn't it? That it's still your brain makes that, like, little connection.
Yeah, it's an impulse. It's an embedded impulse.
Yeah. I don't think I get it so much because I was so young. But Ben, my husband, who lost his dad when he was, like, in his late 20s, his mum, like, mid-30s, he said he still gets the phone call thing.
Oh, yeah.
But I think because I was still living with my dad, I don't have that, like... I would have called him anyway.
Yeah.
I would have just gone home. So was she sick for a long time or what happened?
She had breast cancer about 15 years previously and the treatment had been successful and it had gone away. And then it came back and then it came back and it just came back so suddenly and within 6 months she had died. And it was a very a very shocking time because we thought that, you know, the prognosis was basically quite good.
Yeah.
And the treatment seemed to be working quite well, even second time round. And then suddenly it was like, no, you have to come in. She's on her way out.
So was she in hospital at the time?
Yeah.
Having the treatment?
She died in hospital, yeah.
And were they together? Were your mum and dad together?
Yes, they were. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'm being very personal, but like, how did your dad deal with that?
Well, not well.
Well, because just what you've described him, I was thinking,
Yeah. I mean,
especially if he was 20 years older, that must have not been what anyone thought was going to happen in that kind of, you can't help yourself but play out a narrative.
No, and he was the kind of, you know, depressive, angst-ridden character. My mum was the sunshiny, positive, optimistic character. So you would never have felt it was going to happen that way round.
Yeah.
And he, of course, he found it incredibly difficult. We all did. We all did.
God. So were you, you know, so you weren't living at home then, but you were like, I guess you're from London, aren't you?
Yeah.
So you're just, were you working at the time? So what happened when she died? Were you with her?
I was with her when she died. I closed her eyes after she died. I just remember that sort of bizarre feeling that death brings of complete peace, because there's nothing you can do. The feeling, it's not quite helplessness, it's more resignation to life's processes, isn't it? It's just like, here we are, and this moment is intense and powerful, but it's also slightly beautiful because it is as close and as connected to reality as you can possibly get. And we'd obviously had a little bit of time to get used to the fact that this was coming and that this was inevitable. You just hoped it was a quiet and peaceful passing.
Did you have an opportunity to speak to her at all? Or?
Yeah. No, I got to say goodbye.
You did?
Yeah, I got to say goodbye. And I got to check in with her that she knew what was happening.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Was she in pain, or was it kind of like...
Yeah, she was in pain, but they medicated very well. And I think they did as best a job as they could, really. Mm. So it was a very different passing.
Yeah, that sounds like, as ever, just the way that the world and life works, like, so opposite. But then it sounds like they were very opposite. So
yeah,
I think
they were.
The more deaths I've come across, the more, you know, I'm sort of thinking you live as you die in a way. Like, obviously that doesn't mean if you're happy and great, you'll have a happy and great death. But the process of it, it's... What am I trying to say? It's just so different for each person. There isn't a formula.
Yeah.
Even with if they have cancer, like, and they're at the same hospital, there isn't a formula for how someone goes.
Yeah, yeah.
I like what you said there about that piece. I know what you mean, but yeah, it's almost like you can't... What is it? The only way I can describe it is it feels like a genuine full stop.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not many times in your life you get a genuine full stop.
Yeah,
or like a
true.
Genuine end of... It feels like... I'm so obsessed with narrative. It feels like, this is definitely the end of a chapter.
Yeah.
Like, this is the point that the film, you know, it cuts to black and then we start again. Because it's just... But there is a piece to it, which I think is a very nice way to describe it. So how did you cope after she had died, when you'd obviously been much, much closer to her? Was that very hard? Did you feel like you went through the grieving process then?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because I don't know how I would describe what is a grieving process.
Yeah.
It's something that I'd got used to. I'd realised that this was going to happen, that there was no way we could save her. And then it was just coping with that sense of loss.
Yeah.
But that is coping, isn't it? It's not, you know, I've certainly been on the other end of this, where I'm counselling someone who is grieving and they say, I can't cope. And you have to remind them, well, this is the coping.
Yeah.
You are here and you're going through whatever you're going through. That is coping.
Mm.
And I had some support around me, and it was obviously a difficult time, but it was, there's something about the inevitability of it that makes me think, well, you just cope. You just deal with it.
I never forget when, after Ben's dad died, and he was having a real, like, this maybe it was like a year or something. And we were like, we were having this row, and he was like, I'm just not coping. And I remember saying to him, and he said, this always stuck with me. I was like, this is it. This feeling shit and like not wanting to get up and feeling awful, like the world is collapsing. I was like, that is coping.
This
that
is your coping. This is coping.
Because you are here and you got up.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, that's all you can do, is just, if you carry on to the next day. You've coped.
Yeah.
But I think people think coping is feeling better.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. It's
not
that at all.
It definitely isn't. It definitely isn't.
And also, you want to make sure you live a good life because of the person who brought you into the world.
Yeah,
and so you've got things to focus on. And you can focus on the memory of them and you can focus on the positives. And that's, I know, absolutely know that that's what my mother would have wanted.
Yeah.
And that phrase, what they would have wanted, is a really bizarre one, isn't it?
It's really, yeah.
It's like you're directing yourself somehow.
It's also, you always have to trust that you do know what they wanted because people surprise you. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I'm very close to my mum, but I still think, do I really know what she, in every account? And that's what I don't like sometimes. When people are like, oh, it's what you would have wanted, you have to think, well, that's what we think he would have wanted.
Yeah.
It's our best educated guess. Did you have any counselling or anything after your mum, or did you just get sort of, get on with it?
Not immediately, no. I think I've been through different forms of counselling and therapy at different times in life. I don't think I had anything immediately around that time. No, I don't know how I've processed it, actually, Carrie. I don't know. I've just decided that that's happened. It happened. And I miss her very much.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And that is the business of being a human on planet Earth. You're going to experience that. And on you go.
But you're very stoic about it.
I'm a pretty stoic person. Yeah, I'm pretty stoic.
Have you always been like that? Or do you feel like you've developed stoicism?
I've developed stoicism, definitely.
Oh, yeah, because you said you were very sensitive.
Mm, yeah.
So do you think it's a way of protecting yourself because you were so sensitive as a child? You've had to, go, right, this is the little coat I'm going to put on to make myself be able to be sensitive. Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know where that comes from. I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It's difficult to know.
Because when you were a child and you say you were oversensitive, what was your reaction more likely to be as a child, is what I'm wondering. There wouldn't have been okay, I'll just get on with it.
I would have been pushed to tears very quickly.
Oh, really?
And much more emotional and emotionally expressive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then really through my teens started to close that down.
Wow.
Some of that in a protective and healthy sense, some of it in an unhealthy sense, which I've had to obviously process since. And that's an ongoing thing for me in life, processing how I do that and why I do that sort of thing. Stoicism, I think I'm pretty stoic.
You're very stoic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think what you've just described is the epitome of stoicism. I just decided that's being a human. And also, I'm just thinking, because I know, and again, this is the privilege of knowing you, Adam, you're a very emotional performer. You're not someone who isn't emotional when you perform, which sometimes, especially in improv, you get people who just aren't very good at expressing emotions. They can do story or they can be funny, but when it comes to anything sensitive, but you are the most sensitive emotional form. Do you think that allows you?
Yeah.
Is that where you allow that little bit to peek out again?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think that's why I got into the whole subject in the first place.
Yeah.
Sort of age 13 to 15 was when I really started to discover it. It was like, here's a safe place for my emotions.
Yeah.
I can be as emotional as I like, and the only consequence is people say, oh, that was good, well done. whereas in life, my emotions were really going through a tempestuous place because of how my father would process them and what they meant to him. Remember, he's a solipsist. He was a solipsist. So my emotions were not my own. They were a reflection of him. And, oh, my cursed life. Look at my son is doing this. That's my curse to carry and my cross to bear. It's like, whoa, okay.
Wow.
That you don't get that when you're 13. There's no way of understanding why that could happen or why someone would do that, other than your father doesn't like you is the sort of sentence that comes in. Your father judges you. You are bad. And, there's no other... It's very difficult to get any balance on that until later in life.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And I think that father-son dynamic is so... that's what I have... I think it's mother-daughter thing. It's hard to explain. It can be much more complicated. I don't know, you get into this whole idea of gender, but my dad and my brother had a complication that I never quite understood. Because we both had the same father who was complicated for very different reasons, but there was always, I guess I can see a softness that he had with me that he didn't have with him. I can see it. It's really hard. I couldn't describe it to you. I couldn't pinpoint it. I couldn't say, but I could just in the manner on the way, or I guess when people are emotional or things happen, the way I was dealt with, there's just even if it's 1% of softness over what my brother would get, it obviously adds up, doesn't it? So I think
it is amazing. Mm. And when, you know, you look at other people's relationships,
yeah.
other father-son relationships yeah. or other mother-daughter relationships or whatever, and you go, what must that be like? What must it be like? What kind of what person would I be
yeah.
if that was my upbringing instead? And there's no blame attached to this.
No,
it's not like
no.
I blame my father for what he did. He just was the way he was.
Yeah.
But it's so bizarre to think about the alternative lifelines
yeah.
and time streams you would have lived in had yeah. your familial relationships been different.
I find, especially since having a child, and I see Ben being a dad, and he, I mean, obviously I would say this, I think he's an amazing dad, but I see him do things and I think, why is he doing that? That's not what dads do. Like,
yeah,
and having
right.
to be like, oh, Gary, dads can do, they can yeah. do that. They
this
can
is Ben,
be,
dad.
They can be around.
Yeah.
It's not a hassle. It, like, if you ask them to do things, it's not an interruption, or, you know, they're working, which my dad had this big thing of, like, the work men. We just weren't allowed to go near him. You know, he was working. And, like, yeah, I sort of, you start looking at your child thinking, wow, she's going to have a completely different relationship with her dad that I struggle to understand. Because I often think, oh, she's going to really like him. What's that like? It's like, if he's, like, there and she likes him, that'll be nice for her.
I've got a good friend who's an actor, and he's just the most positive person on the planet.
Yeah.
And he's just positive all the time. And every time something happens, he'll go, oh, well, maybe we could do this. And he just seems undaunted by obstacle. And I said to him once, how are you like this?
Yeah.
And he said, oh, I don't really know. And he thought about it a bit. And he said, well, my father would treat everything as an initiative test.
Wow.
He's like, everything that happens, you know, potential disasters coming their way.
Yeah.
Well, all right, family, this is an initiative test. Let's pull together and see what we can do.
Yeah.
And I looked at him in awe, and I just thought, I have no concept of what that would be like. I can imagine,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I can't live that through you. I can't vicariously yeah. experience it, and I certainly can't directly experience it.
Yeah.
That accounts for so much.
So much. That reminds me of my dad, because it was always like, his catchphrase was, don't give me problems, give me solutions to everything.
Mm-hmm.
So even like, oh, I can't find my shoes. Don't give me problems, give me solutions. Like, let's work through. Where were they? Which I was talking to my therapist about it, and I was like, it's a great attitude for business. It's quite hard for a family.
Yeah.
Like, but like, you know, you work yeah. with me. Like, if I'm in a situation like, right, guys, let's work this out. How are we going to do this? I've got ideas. Adam, you give me ideas. We can all do this. And it's like, I can see myself, what was called in my childhood being bossy, but I now know is leading. And I can see it's a really good strength, and it definitely comes with my dad, but I can also see it's tiring. It's really tiring having to, like, drive all the time like
yeah.
that and feel like you have to, and which again, like, yeah, I'm just saying, like, there's never, you know, even though your friend has a positive attitude, there's always this other side to it of, like, I bet that's tiring, always being on initiative tests.
Yeah.
I bet once you just wanted your dad to solve a problem.
Yes.
And just say,
or just have a row with you.
Yeah, yeah. Or just not worry about it. Go, oh, well, it'll be all right. But, yeah, like, I am incapable of not trying to fix things, definitely.
Yeah. And then, of course, what happens when you know that they've gone?
Yeah.
Are you left with this character that you only had because of your yeah. relationship with them?
And how do you feel like you said, oh yeah, the stoicism that you developed, do you feel like, I think I know the answer to this, but like, do you regret that that's what you've had to do, or you're in a place where you're happy with your character?
I am so amazingly selfish, Carriad. I'm so happy with my character. I really have a great time being me. I really do. I'm so selfish. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. I don't know if it's selfish. I think it can. It's like
there's
all things.
There's elements
a scale.
Of selfishness.
Yeah, there's an element
yeah.
of selfishness, but also it's an element of self-preservation, I suppose. As well,
and
like
self-assuredness, which is fine.
Yeah.
But so, and I'm going to be honest about the negative qualities too.
Yeah, sure.
Definitely
sure.
some selfishness.
Yeah.
You know, profoundly so at times. But but I'm kind of happy with that. You know, it's not like I go around pretending I'm not that.
But you're one of those sneaky, quiet, selfish people, I think.
That's the deadly combination.
They're deadly.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say this, and people will laugh, but you're a Libra, and my brother's a Libra, and my husband's a Libra. So.
Libra time.
Yeah, and my brother definitely has that. He has ability to get his own way in the quietest. Whereas I'm much more like, if I want something, I shout about it. I want this.
Yeah.
This is how I want it to be, because I don't trust it. I'm going to get it. Whereas my brother, it's like that stealth selfishness, which I think I do recognise in you. Of like, it's just happened. Suddenly, we are doing what Adam wanted, but it, there's a want to make that person happy.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like, but I don't know, it's very hard, like you said, to pin down.
Well, I guess I've distilled my father's solipsism and my mother's rampant optimism and generosity and sort of come up with this sort of tepid water of selfishness somewhere in the middle.
It's really working for you, though.
Yeah, it is working, actually.
Yeah,
it's working.
So you feel like at peace with what you inherited from, well, especially from him, because obviously there's always the one parent that you're like, ugh, look what I got from you, I think, sometimes.
Well, it's been an interesting journey.
Yeah. Yeah, but now, obviously you feel like you've come at peace. Was there a time then when you were, like, do you ever get this? Because I do wonder this about your stoicism. Like, it's a reaction to how your dad behaved.
In a large part, must be. Yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So do you ever, you feel... Not, what's the word, like, resentful, like, that you've had to do that? Is there ever a part of Adam that wants to behave in the way that your dad did? Is there ever that, like, fuck it, why can't I do that?
No, I think there's probably, well, if it is, that's a very unconscious part and I haven't come to recognise it.
Yeah.
And it's quite likely that that exists, but I just don't see it. It's a blind spot, I would have thought. But I also would fear to be so... solipsistic and temperamental. Like I said earlier, I don't like losing my temper in public because it makes me feel like it's what he did and I didn't like that. this is so ugly. So I really wouldn't want to be that way.
But
that comes at a certain cost when sometimes you have to be that way or it's really advantageous to be that way or self-expressive to be that way and you want to purge something and you're not, you know, you're a little bit trapped. I mean me.
Yeah.
I.
But isn't that's what I mean? Because that's what I mean. We were saying, I'm not being very clear today, but like when you think a parent has a negative quality, they do to you as a child, but that quality will be positive in other ways. Like my dad with his business, it was like I could see that as a dad, sometimes it was really shit, but I could see when he was at work, it was really great. And like you'll see, I think that's really interesting. I'm sure as a father, that temperamentalness, but perhaps as a dancer, that's why everyone was like, oh God, you know, he was on fire. Like,
that's true. He was meant to be quite an astounding dancer. He was Bob Fosse's principal dancer for a while. Yeah. Worked with Martha Graham and Alvin Ailey and Tally Beattie and Jerome Robbins. And
did you see him dance?
A little. In the 70s when I was growing up and I could see him, you know, do a dance class or something. But before I really knew what it all meant.
Yeah.
But I've seen, obviously, I'm aware of the huge tribute paid to him by a number of students who studied with him, particularly in the 70s and 80s. And there have been a large number of people coming forward after they heard about his death saying quite what he meant to them, you know.
How did that feel?
I understood that completely. And also because I teach in the world of dramatic art. So I understand what it is to have that relationship with students and how important students are and how much you care for your students. And when you really commit your life to these students, of course you're going to develop this great bond. And they only see the best of you.
Yeah,
you know, they're only going to see the best of you. They're only going to see a particular side of you. Which is you kind of on fire in the room inspiring people.
Yeah.
And that's a privilege. That's a real privilege. Teaching is an absolute privilege. And I think he was considered to be a very fine teacher.
Did you ever feel the, I'm only saying this, like, did you ever feel the urge to be like, that's not what he was really like?
No,
obviously
I never feel
that.
Because
you're so stoic. Well, you didn't. You just, when people, because I've never forgotten, I was walking down the street with you once and someone stopped us. Do you remember this was years ago? And someone was like, oh, you're Ivan Makedo's son. Oh my God.
No, I don't remember this.
Yeah, they started saying to you, oh my God, your father. Oh my God. And they were like,
yes.
And you were very kind, polite, and said thank you. And then you just walked off and you were like, oh yeah, I don't really talk to him. And I remember being like, what? Like, your dad's this famous tap. Like, the way, you know, it was like such a juxtaposition. But you.
Well,
I guess you're used to it.
I cannot judge what he was to other people.
Yeah.
And he was an inspiration to people, no doubt about it. So that's great that they had that.
Yeah.
I just think that would be very petty of me to try and say, oh, no, you don't know what he was really like. You know, I think that would be... No, it's not in my nature to do that.
No, it's not. But again, I think that's a real strength. I think that's a real strength at that peace that you have to separate this. I mean, yeah, you know, I'm sure it comes with other problems, but to be able to... I think it sounds like you really see him as a person, which I think a lot of people don't. They still talk... And I find this... I find it very hard not to be the 15-year-old, to be the child. I think it takes quite a lot of therapy, time and courses to see them very equally as a person.
That's interesting. I think that last argument that we had that we were talking about earlier was probably the first time we spoke to each other man to man.
Wow.
Where it wasn't, where no more, it wasn't really in the lens of father-son as much as it was these things need to be said between two people.
Wow, yeah.
And so they're being said.
And I guess that must have helped you feel, not calm, but like it was said.
It was said.
It was done.
Yeah, yeah. It was said.
And it so then your mum died 18 years ago and you said you then lost the rest of the family.
Yeah.
Did that happen soon or was that like sort of just over
the years?
Had
quite a big family on my mother's side and my mother really was the sort of linchpin of that. So when my mother went, life just went in different directions. And
so sad, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, all the members of my mother's family are close and made efforts to continue to keep seeing each other and keep the family together. But I sort of extricated myself from that. And I think that was part of my coping mechanism. Yeah. I think this is all about retreating into oneself so that you can figure it all out and be a better person. And for me, it was not going to come in the family setup, which I know is the cause of some regret and grievance for people in my family.
Oh, really?
Some who are still alive and some who are not.
Yeah.
But all I can say is that is what I had to do to survive.
Yeah.
For good or ill, that's what I did.
So you kind of...
So I lost contact with a lot of that family and then, of course, heard that they died and went to various funerals over the years. Funeral, you know, it's the funeral age. It's the funeral age. It's the sad age of funerals and friends with cancer.
You've been listening to Friends with Cancer with Carrie Lloyd.
It's a lovely sunny day out there, Carrie.
I know,
and here
it's
we
so
are
nice.
Talking about cancer.
In a really hot room as well.
In a hot room,
I just find it really... Sorry, I think I'm being more... What's the word? Nosy than I would with another guest because I do know you. So feel free to tell me I'm taking liberties.
Oh no, nose
away.
I just
find it interesting that you have that sort of self knowledge to extricate yourself in that way. Like, cause again, I think a lot of people. So my dad dies. My dad dies. I'm 15. 6 months later, my grandpa died, and he was the patriarch. He was in charge of everything. It was my dad's dad, and he literally just gave up. He couldn't cope. And I've said it before, he just walked around and he just kept saying to me, it's not right, Carriad. It's the wrong way around. And he just gave up. And he was the linchpin. Right. He held everything together. And after he died, this family that had supported me and loved me and been around just fell apart. Like everybody felt, all these aunts and uncles and cousins that suddenly just aren't part of your life anymore. And I, for years, would be like desperately trying to get people back together, desperately. And I remember being so frustrated that people wouldn't, you know, like, we are a family. We should cut. And it took me a long time to be like, there was a lot of stuff going on. And that's why.
And you're being protected.
Yeah, I was being protected. And I think it takes great maturity to sort of, and my brother had that a little bit, actually. I remember him saying to me once, like, just because you're related to people doesn't mean you like them or you have to go on with them. And I was like, no, we're all in this together. Like, I have such a thing of like wanting everyone to still be around. But I think I think my brother has as well, it takes a lot of strength to extricate yourself, is what I'm trying to say. To say, for my own survival, I need to not be part of this.
So I think that's just a different kind of strength. Your strength of trying to keep a family together is just an equal kind of strength.
Yeah.
It's just in a different direction, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's community-based,
which is why it must be hard if you, like you said, causing grievances, I guess, if other people were like, no, we need to come together in this situation. But I think the way you put it was really nice of like retreating to work out what's going on.
Mm.
And I think I'm at the other end of the scale, which is coming together to work out what's going on. So it's exactly this, wanting the same thing of like, I want us all to be in the room so we can figure out what the fuck just happened.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you're like, I want to be alone so I can figure out what the fuck just happened.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ah, well, maybe that's an introvert extrovert thing.
Yeah, yeah. My way of coping is to talk and express and, you know, communicate with people. But your way of coping is to go in and have that conversation. And what's interesting is we're having the same conversations, but you're having it with yourself. And I'm just having it with someone else. But they are the same conversation. You know what I mean? It's the same thing of like, why did this happen? What does this mean? Who am I?
Yeah.
And I find, I did have it with myself, but I just suppose I just find it easier to just talk it out. Always easier to talk it out. It's like if I am left alone too long, the conversation doesn't happen. It just like sort of festers.
Yeah. Well, that talking to oneself is often out loud.
Yeah,
just hopefully
yeah.
not on a tube. But it is, you know, it's definitely words that are... given voice, and I have to hear them.
Yeah.
I have to hear myself saying them.
Oh, wow.
Rather than just things rattling around my head.
That makes me feel better, because I have to hear them.
Mm.
And that's why I need someone else to hear them.
Yeah.
So I'm like, did you hear them? Yes, good. Then I'm not... But you do speak out loud to yourself.
Oh, Definitely. And I have to check that I'm not doing it in public as I get older. I'm of an age now, Carrot.
I'm of an age
where I, you know, find food on me. It's like, how did that get there? I must be in my 40s. Yeah. So, yeah, I have to check myself.
Yeah.
I like my own company and I like hearing myself talk to myself. You know, I enjoy it and I get a lot of strength and solace from that. I do.
That's really nice. But it's nice it's really nice as someone who needs to talk to someone to know that, because I think I always... You put value judgments on it. So I'm like, oh, if I was stronger, I wouldn't need to talk to someone.
Yeah.
Because actually it's nice to go, oh, no, you are just you just haven't got an audience.
I always require an audience. These are not pejorative terms. I mean, the processes, and as you've pointed out, they're the same processes. It's just they're either done with other people or you're doing them with the other people in your own head.
Yeah,
you know, the
yeah.
other voices that you carry around from your past and your childhood or whatever. So it's the same. You're absolutely right. It's the same process. It's just expressed in a slightly different manner.
I think it's really nice if you can, because we come from different ends of the scale, to understand that what someone else is doing is the same. Because I definitely suffered from that with my brother, I think, and other members of the family being like, they're not doing it how I am, therefore they're not doing it, or they're not doing it right, or they don't understand what I'm doing. You know, that because I think especially as a family, and it must have, I think you and your sister are amazing that you were able to very much respect each other's process. I think it's a lot easier if you can just look at someone and go, they are doing it, just not the way I would.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that it's not like that process isn't happening.
But also, you know, you were 15. And that's a very different thing. It's a really...
I forget.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is the thing we talked about before. When you're 15, you think you know everything. So it's still very hard to accept that I was a child. Like, I said that to my husband recently of like, I was like, oh, but why did I do that? And he was like, you were 15. I was like, oh, yeah. Because I judge myself very similarly to as I would now in my 30s. I'm like, no, it's the same person. Because I am the same person, but obviously, you know, you're not. Now you are essentially an orphan in the dictionary sense.
I'm a traditional orphan.
Traditional orphan. Covered in food.
Yeah, covered in mystery food.
Directing improv shows. Did it feel any different, like when you knew, like you said, when your dad was, okay, he's dead, that's it, it's just me and my sister now? Or did it just feel like...
It felt quite peaceful.
Yeah.
It felt quite peaceful. It felt that, like I say, his suffering... was now over. My sister, I very much hope, can, you know, have some of her life back.
Yeah.
Although that's unfair to say, because it makes it sound like she didn't have a life. That was her choice and her passion and her love, and she wanted to care for him and have her relationship with her father in that way, and she did that, and all power to her for doing so. So I don't mean to... I'm not... My choice of words was clumsy, that's all.
Yeah.
But I'd love her to have some peace for herself.
Yeah.
Because it's been a tempestuous ride for her.
God, yeah, for both of you, it sounds. Like I said, it's same process, just done very, very differently.
Well, she was the one, you know, dealing with the, like, hands-on, physical, full-time care of an elderly man.
Yeah.
For a long period of time. And a man who was not easy and could be very unpleasant. And, you know, so she did all of that and continued admirably, really admirably.
And I must ask, because I've got, what was your mum's name?
Jill.
Jill.
So Jill and Evil Megiddo.
Jill and Evil. Well, Adam, thank you so much for coming to talk to me.
Thank you. I can't believe I talked about it.
How do you feel now? Do you feel all right?
Yeah, okay. Good.
Was it okay?
It's great. No, thank you. It was really good.
Do you need to go away and have a talk with yourself about it?
We can talk about it.
Okay. Once it's finished.
Thanks, Carrot.
Thanks. You can follow Adam on Twitter at Adam Megiddo, and you can also see him with the Showstoppers. If you head to theshowstoppers.org, you can find out details of their shows. They're currently in the West End, they're going to Edinburgh, and they're on tour all around the UK. Do go and see the show, it's amazing. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at TheGriefCast, and you can email me, thegriefcast@gmail.com. Also, if you get a chance, please do rate, review and subscribe if you've enjoyed the show. It really does help other people find out about us. The show was edited by Kate Holland, with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music is provided by The Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.